Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, new hopes for the church in Cuba as the Vatican Secretary of State returns from a week-long visit to the island. And campaign coffee on sale in a church near you as the Fair Trade Fortnight kicks off around the United Kingdom. Vatican Secretary of State Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone this week became the first foreign diplomat to meet with Cuba's new president, Raúl Castro, just 2 days after he took over the reins of power from his ailing brother, Fidel Castro. During a week-long visit to the Caribbean island nation, the Cardinal reiterated Pope John Paul's condemnation of the American embargo on Cuba, describing it as ethically unacceptable. He also called for closer contacts between Havana and the international community. He raised concerns about prisoners and their families and called for greater freedom for the church to express its views through the state-controlled media. During the visit, which marked the 10th anniversary of Pope John Paul's historic trip to Cuba, state-run television broadcast live a mass in Havana's cathedral and a news conference where the cardinal welcomed the release of 4 political prisoners. In a rare gesture towards the church, the Communist Party paper also published on Tuesday a statement by the Catholic bishops, calling on the government to move quickly to resolve the most pressing problems facing the impoverished nation.
There's a terrible economic crisis within Cuba, and that obviously dates back to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dissolution, really, of the socialist bloc of countries. Basically deprived Cuba of most of its trading partners.
Claire Dixon is head of the Latin America and Caribbean desk for CAFOD, the London-based Catholic Agency for Overseas Development. She sees the Cardinal's visit as the latest step in a slow process of normalising relations between church and state since Fidel Castro led the communist takeover of the country almost half a century ago.
I mean, certainly there has been a slow evolution of the relationship between the church and the state in the years of the revolution. It started off with a certain amount of mistrust on both sides in the early 60s, and then that became much more open confrontation in the wake of the invasion of the Bay of Pigs. And of course, there were a number of Catholic priests who were involved in that. But after 20 years, more or less, of silence, the church and the state tried to start thinking about what was it that they could actually talk about. What were the things that united them rather than the things that separated them? So I guess the example of liberation theology, the role of the church in the rest of Latin America, was a very big lesson for certainly the government in Cuba. And I think the church in Cuba, over the years, even during the years of its silencing and its lack of access to the media, was always very much a Cuban patriotic church. They never allowed the criticisms that they might have had of the government to be used as a stick to hit the government with. So, for instance, they never wanted to go public on some of their concerns because they were always aware that the United States might be able to use this as a means of further isolating the Cuban government. And so I think on that basis, there has been a growing, and certainly since the mid-80s, a burgeoning relationship. Just last year, the Catholic Church came and said that the relationship that they were having with the state was being removed of its imperfections and that it was a positive relationship. And certainly that's been the main headline over the last decade or so.
So how would you describe the state of the church today, or perhaps what role does it play today in the life of the country?
Well, of course, Catholics are a proportion of the population who have always been part and parcel of the workforce, of the people. Catholics, of course, as the state is the only real employer, have always worked at every level of the Cuban bureaucracy. And until 15 years or so ago, of course, they were unable to join the party. But now there has been the removal of the ban on any believers being members of the Communist Party. Now, that was a measure that came in the mid-80s. I would say that there hasn't been a huge flourishing of Catholic membership of the Communist Party, but there have been quite a lot of members of the Communist Party who've actually come out and said, well, we always maintained our Catholic faith, but we just didn't talk about it. And so it's something which is part and parcel of Cuban society in the same way as it's part and parcel of other societies, but it just hasn't been talked about in the same way.
So what would you see as the most serious problems perhaps facing the church there today?
Well, I guess the church, as part of the wider Cuban society and community, is restricted in all sorts of ways. I mean, obviously, you know that there's a terrible economic crisis within Cuba. There has been a huge effort to try and attract foreign currency, and particularly Canada and Japan and Spain have invested heavily in both industries and in the tourist industry. But for most Cubans, and that includes the church, access to foreign currency, access to materials, building materials, the construction of churches, access to the media, purchasing of paper, basically the basic wherewithal for the church to carry out a more public role, have been quite limited. And of course, in Cuba, the key role of the church prior to the revolution was in the provision of education. The very, very high quality, but also highly elitist system was run by the church. The Christian Brothers, the Marist Fathers, and the Jesuits were always a very key component of the private education system in Cuba. And of course, in the early 60s, there was a nationalization of education, which hit the church hard, particularly in its role of being able to educate the future leaders of the country. But as you know, Fidel himself was educated by both the Christian Brothers and by the Jesuits, and therefore they have had some influence upon him.
We've just seen, of course, Fidel Castro handing over to his brother, Raúl. Do you expect to see any change in policy or attitude towards the church under this new leadership?
Well, I think that throughout the last 10, 15 years, Fidel's advisors have been very aware that the Catholic Church was around for many years before the revolution, and that therefore it was very likely that the church was going to be around after the death of Fidel and after the revolution has somehow transformed itself into a more representative and a more accountable democracy. And therefore I think that the whole ethos and the whole relationship between the church and state has warmed over the last number of years, and certainly I would see no reason why that shouldn't continue. After all, Cuba is very, very keen to extend its allies and the Catholic Church as an ally within the country and as an ally internationally is going to be one of the key factors in being able to help Cuba take forward its whole process of normalizing somehow its relationship with the rest of the world.
That, of course, is a very difficult task. It's going to take a long time. What prospects do you see for economic and political improvements, perhaps in the short term, under this new leadership?
Well, I guess the new leadership is definitely going to be short term because Raúl Castro himself is no spring chicken. He's 76 years old. And some of the issues which were expected to kind of come alongside Raúl have not been fulfilled. Instead of having one of the bright young sparks, one of the kind of the current vice president, Carlos Laje or Roberto Robaina, who has been a very progressive influence within the Cuban state, we expected that they might have been the successor to Raúl, the named successor. But in fact, it looks as though the ticket was balanced up with somebody who was a very old and rather hardline communist. So it's difficult to say, really.
What kind of role do you think the international community should be playing at this point in the nation's history?
Well, I think the Catholic Church has been very good at trying to hold a mirror up to society, to try and put into words, through pastoral letters and through private approaches, the concerns that everybody knows about within Cuba, but nobody speaks about publicly. And therefore, it's something kind of like holding a mirror up to the country to say, this is who we are and how can we go forward? Clearly, there is no real sign of a massive political liberalisation, But certainly there does seem to be a certain hope, as far as the Cuban state is concerned, to be able to progress economically, perhaps along the similar lines to the way China has progressed. Of course, Cuba isn't China, and Cuba can't really be equated with any of the former socialist countries of Eastern Europe. And there is a huge influence as well of the rest of the Latin American region, and also the church as part and parcel of that region. What Cuba really wants to be is fully integrated and working closely again with its neighbours in Latin America, who share a culture and who at bottom share a kind of an identity which is very Catholic in its roots.
Cardinal Bertone has been marking the 10th anniversary, of course, of Pope John Paul's historic visit to Cuba. How much do you think that was really a turning point, perhaps, in the way the church was viewed in the country?
Things in Cuba tend to move glacially slowly. And so the Pope's visit in 1998 was the culmination of a much longer process of kind of rapprochement, dialogue, negotiation. That started in the early 80s with the church's whole process of renewal. The church looked at itself and it looked at Cuban society and it said, well, if the church can perform a service to capitalist societies, as it does throughout the world, what is stopping us from being a service to a socialist society? Because at the end of the day, the basic and fundamental messages of Christianity and of socialism in terms of loving one's neighbour and having a responsibility towards the community actually would seem to be closer than what the church would have in common with capitalism. And so that long process started, and the church itself had this whole process of ecclesial renewal, in which in 1985 they came out very strongly to say that the church has to be incarnate in society, it has to be a missionary within society. And of course, whilst the theology of liberation as such didn't develop within Cuba, what you did have from the late 70s, early 80s was the development, particularly within the Catholic seminary in Cuba, in Havana, of a theology of reconciliation, of saying, what is it that we can come to terms with? What is it that we can agree on? And let's try and put kind of further into the background those things that we can disagree on.
As you say, there is a severe economic crisis in the country. What role do the Catholic aid agencies like CAFOD play there today?
Well, one of the roles that CAFOD has been playing has been trying to support this whole process of negotiation, of dialogue, of bringing people together from the church and from different sectors of society as people of goodwill, saying, what is it? We haven't been providing huge amounts of resources in the way of medicines, because obviously the Cuban health system is far in advance of any of the others in the Latin American region, and education, which is kind of the fundamental building block of the community, has also been quite impressive in Cuba in terms of its achievements. What there has been, of course, is been the tremendous economic blockade. Now, the church in Cuba has been enormously important in always saying, we are a church which is patriotic, we are nationalistic, we are Cuban. What we want is to see the end of the embargo, the boycott, and the very negative attitudes towards Cuba held by the United States. And of course, one of our partners, Catholic Relief Services in the United States, has done some quite heroic stuff, because of course the US does not regard any visitors to Cuba as in a good light. And Catholic Relief Services has done a great deal to try and ensure that basic supplies of medicines, which would not be easily available in Cuba, have been sent into the country, and has been recognized by the Cuban government as being able, as the church, making a real contribution towards the whole issue around dialogue and reconciliation.
We saw Pope John Paul, of course, 10 years ago, describing the American embargo as oppressive, unjust and ethically unacceptable. What kind of pressure do you think perhaps the Cardinal Secretary of State may be able to put in that sense to try and bring an end to this embargo?
Well, I think the position of the church all along at the level of the Vatican and at the level of the local church within Cuba has always been unequivocal in this regard. And I'm sure that this will give a kind of an added impetus. The visit of Cardinal Bertone has been massively reported in the Cuban press. I think it has been celebrated throughout Cuban society. And it's a means of ensuring that Pope Benedict will be able to carry forward that whole process of reconciliation and negotiation and moral authority which was brought to the Cuban case by Pope John Paul II.
And my thanks there to Claire Dixon, head of the Latin American and Caribbean desk for CAFOD, the London-based Catholic Agency for Overseas Development. The annual Fair Trade Fortnight was launched in the United Kingdom this past weekend. Its aim to encourage more consumers to choose items bearing the Fair Trade guarantee that farmers in developing countries have been paid a fair price for their goods. This year's Fortnight of awareness-raising events kicked off as the sugar giant Tate & Lyle announced it was becoming the largest UK firm to carry the Fair Trade label. The Catholic Church and other faith groups have been strongly supportive of this campaign to help farmers, their families and communities in the poorest parts of the world. Father Joe Ryan heads the Justice and Peace Commission for London's Westminster Diocese, which has focused on the Fair Trade campaign in a recent ecumenical multimedia project.
Just 10 days ago, we had a launch of a CD and some material which we would hopefully send out to parishes in connection with justice and peace issues. And one of the main items, or one of the items in that particular release was to do with fair trade and encouraging people to learn a bit more and to investigate and to understand and appreciate and get involved in fair trade issues. And mainly the purpose there is to make sure that a fair price is given to farmers and producers, in particularly in third world countries. And so that was one issue that's been ongoing for many years. And now in the recent few days, we've obviously begun our Fair Trade Fortnight. And there are a few events taking place in various parishes in Wellingarn City in Hertfordshire on Friday next at the parish of Queen of Apostles, a film evening showing the Great African Scandal and Black Gold and other issues in order to highlight how we can get involved and be aware of the whole fair trade issue and how it can help the farmers, in particularly in developing countries.
What kind of responses have you had from people there in the parishes? I mean, would you say that this is an issue that people of faith are perhaps more aware of and more responsive to than others?
The response has been very good, particularly because in our parishes we've been carrying fair trade goods now for a number of years. But the brilliant news is that our supermarkets are getting involved. And when you think of the fact that Tate and Lyle have made a decision in the last few days, Tate and Lyle, who are the source of sugar, they will be now using fair trade suppliers. And that's a big breakthrough. But in the parishes, what we are hoping to do is, as well as having the items available at the churches and after masses and in parish halls and using them at various functions, our main aim, one of the things I would like to see and to push forward, is that people would be, in their normal weekly shopping, would actually include the fair trade goods in their shopping. And this would be just a normal routine situation where they're looking for tea and coffee and fresh fruits and bananas and wine and roses and all the thousand items that are on the fair trade market now.
Lent is a particularly good time. The season of Lent is a particularly good time, isn't it, to be trying to get people to become more aware of these issues and the way in which their actions can affect others.
Yes, indeed. And this is the great value of the Fair Trade Fortnight. And as it happens, it falls right in the middle of Lent. I suppose when people are maybe a little bit more conscious of their brothers and sisters in need, more conscious of what it is traditionally, the whole concept of Lent has to do with prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. And not so much that we're giving alms to the poor, but what it means is that we are raising the consciousness, and in that way we are actually returning to many people in the third world some of what is already their rights. So yes, so Lent is a time when people maybe would do things that they wouldn't consider doing other times of the year, and hopefully something that begins in Lent then would be something that would continue and percolate throughout the year, which I think is how it has to be, not just the 2 weeks.
Your new resource, your new CD, talks about the spirituality of justice and peace, doesn't it? Can you give us a little bit more insight into this?
So often when people speak, or when the matter of justice and peace is raised, sometimes people, the eyes glaze over because they feel, well, it's nothing to do with me, or anyhow, I wouldn't, what I say or do doesn't matter. And the very center of what we were putting forward, and the title of our resource, was No Hands But Ours. And that, in a sense, it sums up the whole idea of the ecumenical multimedia resource that we've put forward, that, yes, what we do and say does matter. Like the old saying, if everybody swept in front of their own door, the whole street would be clean. And it's an ongoing thing. And I'm very heartened by the way people have been responding to needs of others, brothers and sisters in need, and particularly people who have no voice of their own, that we as a group who can put forward ideas, and that we have a great responsibility. And part of this resource was to highlight some of that.
You say this is an ecumenical resource, and yet it's true that the churches could do much more together, couldn't they, to really help people in need?
Absolutely, because when we're helping and this is one of the items that was raised very well at our launch day, you know, when somebody is homeless or hungry or not on a fair wage or a migrant, they're not asking, you know, well, what is your particular faith or allegiance? If somebody is there at the time of need, that's the essence. And of course, this is the whole gospel message. I was hungry and you gave me food. I was in prison and you came to my help, and in prison in whatever shape or form. And that's one of the items that we've been pushing for in our ecumenical activities.
Justice comes, it doesn't stop at the minimum. People know that there's change in the air, and I think I'm quite excited about the huge possibility of producers and growers in developing countries having their voices heard.
As field worker for the Westminster Justice and Peace Commission, Barbara Kentish has been actively promoting the fair trade campaign and ideals of trade justice throughout the diocese and beyond.
Well, about a year ago, the Commission decided that we would like to promote Westminster as a fair trade diocese. And what that means is that more than half the parishes have to agree to register with the Fair Trade Foundation, which is a charitable body. And there are three criteria. One is that they must serve fair trade tea and coffee at all their parish meetings. Second, that they should promote other products as well, to increase their use of fair trade. And thirdly, to organise an event during Fair Trade Fortnight to promote the whole concept. So we sent out a survey to find out how many parishes. There are 216 parishes in the diocese, how many parishes were signed up, and it was something like 40 at the time. It's gone up to about 60 now, and tried to encourage, you know, other people in the diocese to take it up. And we did it through articles and talks and organising film evenings. I'm actually talking at two masses about fair trade. I think that one or two of the priests were a bit concerned that we were sort of signing up to the Fair Trade Foundation and we were all too bound up with one particular organisation. I think we have to make clear that fair trade is just part of a movement towards trade justice for you know, so that people in the developing world have the right to a fair deal for their produce and their goods. And if it's through our being more ethical consumers, that's one way. And so that's what this is about. We could also do lobbying of government. And in fact, in my own parish, we're getting people to sign the little cards that we send off to Gordon Brown and say, please, can we have fairer European partnership agreements, which, you know, can cut out third world producers in favour of, you know, European suppliers. I mean, sugar is one of the cases in point, because sugar is produced in Europe and it's produced in developing countries.
There are critics who say that the Fair Trade campaign doesn't really provide more than minimal improvements in the lives of the poorest people, that we need much more significant structural changes, and that Fair Trade is really more about flattering Western shoppers than really transforming lives in developing countries. What's your reaction to that?
I think that it's a beginning. I think it's a beginning of a better relationship with the people that produce our goods. I don't think it's the whole story. I agree that there's a lot of profiteering on the way from producer to supermarket shelf. However, it's a wake-up call to us, and I don't think that we should be fobbed off with people saying, oh, well, it's just to flatter our consciences, or it's just to make the supermarkets look better. I think all the publicity that's going with this is showing us, through either video clips or even feature films, is showing what is happening in these countries. And we can't go into a supermarket anymore in a sort of blind way and think, well, you know, this is all coming to us on some kind of magic conveyor belt. This is coming through people's blood, sweat and tears. And I think it's the thin end of the wedge. I think there's going to be quite a movement. You know, when justice comes, it doesn't stop at the minimum. People know that there's change in the air. And I think I'm quite excited about the huge possibility of producers and growers in developing countries having their voices heard. Friday night, for instance, in Welwyn Garden City, I'm helping to organise a film evening, and we thought it would just be a film evening, but then we got wind of the fact that some producers might be available, and we've got a rice producer from Thailand coming to talk, and she's going to talk about the difference that the Fair Trade Agreement means to their community. So, you know, it's the beginnings of an awakening in other areas. There are moves to make a particular town or city a fair trade town or city. I suspect quite a lot of that is church inspired. Certainly in Welwyn Garden City, I know they're trying to make that a fair trade borough, and I think there are quite a lot of church people involved in that, and they're coming along to our evening. The Fair Trade Foundation itself, of course, was started by the aid agencies like Christian Aid, CAFOD, but also Oxfam, which is not religious, the World Development Movement. So I think there's a broad coalition of people, but, you know, church people are certainly playing a large part.
Thanks there to Barbara Kentish, field worker for the Justice and Peace Commission of the Westminster Diocese. And earlier you heard Father Joe Ryan, chair of that same commission. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. Or if not, find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org, and click on the English icon. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.